Hi, I'm Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal. Today I have the distinct pleasure of chatting with a longtime friend and colleague from just south of me in Oregon. Her name is Judy Bowen, and she's a professor in both the schools of medicine and nursing at Oregon Health and Science University. Again, just below me in the North Pacific U.S. She's a physician by training, but also currently a doctoral student at the University of Utrecht, which operates a program in collaboration with the University of California at San Francisco. I anticipate this is some of her doctoral work that we're going to introduce at this moment. Just before we do that, I'll say that the paper we're going to discuss is titled Chart Stocking, List Making, and Physicians' Efforts to Track Patients' Outcomes, and you'll find it in the April 2018 issue of Medical Education. Judy, thanks for making the time to chat.
Thank you for inviting me, Kevin.
Am I right in believing this is part of your doctoral work?
It is part of my doctoral work.
And fairly obvious to me, at least, knowing that you're a physician by background, why this would be of interest to you. But you start off the paper by talking about the transitions of patient care responsibilities, handover, I suppose, being one example of that. So what are some of the challenges that you've seen in that context, either in your own work or your research, that led you to think this was a topic that needed better exploration?
It's okay. Let me start out by clarifying what we chose to distinguish a handover from a transition of responsibility. Our world is full of handoffs or handovers between teams for temporary coverage, whether that's the night physician covering the day physician in many different settings or weekend coverage. We chose to use the term transition of responsibility to indicate a more permanent transition. At those points of transition, when physicians are finished with a particular shift or rotation and the resulting difficulties with moving on to other work and what it means for following up on unfinished business for the patients that have been transitioned. And I got interested in this work when our duty hours were restricted the second time around by the regulatory bodies, watching out for residents' work-life balance, which of course is very important and not something I want to question in this work, but hospitals in the United States tended to respond to the increasing duty hour restrictions for residents by creating more shift work. And I began to wonder if we needed to explore more deeply the educational consequences of that shift work, because the majority of focus was on resident well-being and patient safety. And nobody was writing or thinking about what happens to education or learning from patient care and through clinical work when handoffs are increasingly frequent, as well as these transitions of responsibility? So that's where I started with this particular work.
Thanks for the clarification, too, that is helpful for setting the context a little bit more specifically. And it seems likely that the long-term goal for focusing on the educational aspects would be, again, patient safety and effective healthcare. Was there's something that you or your colleagues were telling you they had lost educationally when these changes in the practice pattern started to emerge?
Actually, I think that my colleagues were in two different camps. When they talked about themselves, they definitely said, I need to follow up because I have unanswered questions, and I'm not going to let the architecture or the structure of the way we do work to interfere with those curiosities. But they tended to talk about the other. And often it was the experienced attending physicians in the hospital that were watching others become shift workers. And the literature is small around shift working or the identification as a shift worker in internal medicine in particular, which is my specialty. But there has been some concern about whether our architectural discontinuities are creating the expectations for shift working. And even through this work, where the majority of participants in my study spend a lot of time following up and they clearly describe work that is not limited to the shift, they still talk about others who are shift workers. So the sample of participants in my work are voluntary and small because of the nature of the qualitative work. We don't really know if the architectural shift to more restricted duty hours that has resulted in the way we organize teaching and learning in our teaching hospitals is resulting in shift work or not. So I would say it's interesting to see that my colleagues in internal medicine, or at least the participants in the study, tend to claim the higher moral ground that they choose to follow up for the purposes of learning and watching out for patients and advocating for them, while potentially worrying about others, in particular trainees, learning in a system that encourages shift work and handing over a responsibility as being the end of the work and limiting the opportunity to learn through follow-up.
Right, thank you. And I don't know if this is just setting further context or if it's an important methodological feature, but identifying individuals who spontaneously engage in this sort of follow-up now that the architectural change has occurred, is that an indication that this sort of activity in your context currently is something that they do above and beyond their job, so to speak? Are they seeing it purely as education for themselves? And I'm asking in part just to try to help clarify for our listeners the types of physicians that you were speaking with.
Yes, absolutely. Again, these are internal medicine hospitalists and residents training in hospital settings, which is the one place that I found as I began to pursue this line of research has guaranteed shifts every 2 to 4 weeks and built-in transitions of responsibility. So in that context, all of the participants in my study said that they had no obligation or requirement to follow up on patients after the transition, with the exception of paying attention to test results that they personally ordered but had not yet returned back at the time of transition. So some built-in obligation to follow up within the first 24 to 48 hours, but thereafter there is no obligation in their work assignments. So all of the follow-up that they're conducting is in fact driven by curiosity and a passion for knowing the consequences of what's happening.
Which is reassuring in and of itself that they were so readily able to talk about these sorts of things, and implicitly emphasizes the importance, I think, of trying to understand what was creating barriers and what things enabled them to do so effectively. Recognizing that we don't have time to go into all the details, do you mind highlighting some of the things that you thought were most interesting in terms of what enabled people to feel like they could do so effectively?
Yeah, I think probably, Kevin, the most important thing is that these participants in the study were just innately curious about the outcomes of their patients. And what was surprising, perhaps, is that it didn't depend on how long they had their relationship with that patient. The curiosity could be easily driven by unfinished or unanswered or clinical issues and clinical uncertainty, as well as the short-term relationships, that intensity of relationship that we often experience with patients when they're critically ill, and our responsibility is to do the best thing we can to carry out and save lives under some circumstances, but really do the best we can to help people recover by figuring out the nature of the problem, making diagnoses, and initiating treatment that works, or at least begins to stabilize their clinical situation. And I think in the intensity of that care, they just needed to know what happened. Residents, and particularly early residents, tended to be curious about problems that they had never seen before. So their follow-up was clearly for learning the natural history of a condition, or perhaps it's not fair to say the natural history of the condition because we modify that through modern healthcare, but at least to understand how things work out for the disease and the patient and family's experience of that disease. So I would say pleasantly surprised about the driver of curiosity and the rationales for following up, but it does seem to be that the uncertainty drives the need to know. And I would say we've had difficulty figuring out how you can design an experiment to show that follow-up actually builds stronger knowledge bases and improves reasoning expertise. But I'm deeply encouraged by these studies to notice that these physicians are sacrificing time and sometimes rules, as this paper elaborates, to follow up, and that it's important. They perceive it to be important for learning. And the risks and the time sacrifice they're willing to make infers that good learning is occurring.
Yeah, and on top of that, it seems like they've had to develop a number of their own strategies to make that time effective or to enable them to actually do the follow-up because of some of the barriers that might get in their way if they weren't as deliberate about it. Do you mind elaborating on that a little bit? What the physicians found most useful or most problematic when they were trying to build on the curiosity that was driving them in this direction?
We work in an era of electronic health records, and it was really interesting for us to discover how those electronic health records could either facilitate or actually function as a barrier to their abilities to follow up. So the functionality of the electronic health record was important to these participants. When the EHR worked well, it tended to have list-making capabilities, and what people familiar with these kinds of records would recognize as drag and drop functionality, meaning they could click on a particular name and record number and drag it into a protected list that was their personal list for follow-up. And then by dragging and dropping, it was already hyperlinked to the record. So it made it really easy to pop open that personal list that was saved for follow-up and click on that patient's name and get right back into the chart to find out of what had happened, either how other people were reasoning through the clinical case or what specific tests had returned that they had not yet seen. In that particular record, the other facilitator was the ability to annotate the name so that at the time of saving the patient's name, the clinician could put a reminder there to say, this is why it is that I saved this particular name. In a different record, it wasn't possible. It required creating a separate list and retyping names and numbers into a space that was protected. And that was perceived as being an enormous barrier to these participants. And oftentimes they gave up on the electronic list and reverted back to paper lists, which was perceived as a real threat to the patient's personal health information and a deep conflict for many of these physicians. Some abandoned their list making when they knew that they couldn't keep paper lists and stay within the regulations of the learning environment. Others kept lists anyway on paper and took their chances, which I perceive to be the balancing effect of the importance of learning through follow-up and the risk that they were willing to take in that regard. The other thing that we definitely noticed is that the transitions back and forth between different, what I'm going to call tribes, made some difference. They followed up, but their communication with each other about the follow-up information, although in this paper we reported only on the deliberate follow-up, we didn't talk about their conversations. The conversations seemed to be inhibited by those perceived to be outside of the tribe. The internists tend to talk with each other, but they had difficulty talking with the emergency department physicians about what happened if patients were transitioned to them. And in the other direction, if patients were transitioned to the intensive care unit, again, a different architectural discontinuity, the internists in the hospital had difficulty communicating with the internists or specialists in the intensive care unit. And we haven't explored that yet, but it was not an expected finding.
Seems ironic in some ways that we spend so much time when we're talking about, you know, undergraduate levels or more formal training environments about the importance of nurturing and creating the habits of lifelong learning and education. And here's a group who has an innate curiosity, as you described it, and there are real dangers, it sounds like, of squashing that and actually the system taking them away from what the educational practices are meant to lead them towards. So with that as the framing, do you have any final thoughts, given what you've discovered so far in terms of what systems, administrators or educators or clinicians should be doing in order to avoid putting out the fire that so many people struggle to light?
A couple of thoughts. The first one would be that the more efficient we can create these systems to help physicians follow up, if the drive is there, then we should be putting energy into increasing those efficiencies, not designing electronic health record systems that are full of barriers for the purposes of protecting patients or the perceived need to protect patients' privacy, but to balance that need, not to abandon it certainly, but to balance that need with the desire to be able to get back into that record efficiently to find out the consequences of prior clinical decisions. So we know by virtue of our work here that we had two different hospitals that had two different electronic health records, and one was pretty easy to use and the other was very difficult. And so we know that it's possible. I would say parenthetically that when it's really easy to keep track of patients on these personal lists, the lists get big and bulky, and that creates yet another barrier. So the second piece of advice I would have is that we need to figure out what are best practices and how can we start from the very beginning with our residents and teach them about those best practices. The residents and faculty in my study taught each other how to do this, and it was very haphazard. We have statements from our senior hospitalists saying, I just learned how to do this from one of the first year residents. And we have residents saying, I see my attending physicians following up and creating lists, and each one does it a little bit differently, and I'm still experimenting with my list. And all of that, while maybe necessary to fine tune one's particular habit, we haven't created any educational processes to help that learning occur efficiently and effectively so that they can get on about their work of using the list to follow up on patients. And then the third thing that I would say is that my work is limited to talking with trainees, residents in internal medicine, and hospitalists in internal medicine, and has not included the voice of the patient. And we really do need to bring together the views that patients have about following up on their records. It was interesting for us to hear the word chart stocking from many of the participants that we interviewed. At first, it was a term that we were a little reluctant to use and then settled on including it in the title because it seems to be the common way, the folk term, as it were, that this particular culture is using to describe this work. But it does imply that the clinicians are looking into charts with patients being unaware that they're being watched. And I do think that we need to explore that further. To have patients understand that this is for learning and for care, for the patient in particular, and potentially for future patients, the learning can improve how we take care of similar problems going forward. But we shouldn't leave the patients out of the conversation. And those are the things that we need to attend to going forward.
That is all very good advice, and it sounds like it's a good thing you've committed to doctoral studies, given that you have a bit more work to do.
Indeed.
It's a great contribution, though, even already, and so valuable to have some light shone on people who are trying to do what we as educationalists encourage and maybe hitting barriers. So congratulations, first of all, on such an interesting study and on keeping the lens on the hope that education takes place throughout one's career, and again, moving the field beyond just thinking about those early stages into what's actually happening in reality with the workplace with those who are fully qualified. I'll just close off then by reminding our listeners that I've been speaking with Judy Bowen, who's a professor in both schools of medicine and nursing at Oregon Health and Science University. And the paper we've been discussing is titled Chart Stocking, List Making, and Physicians' Efforts to Track Patients' Outcomes. And you'll find it in the April 2018 issue of Medical Education. I hope the rest of your studies go very well and look forward to hearing about what comes next.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.